After the March 8th meeting of the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee, and our first bill today is going to be House File 1545, and the author is making his way to the testifying table right now. And I will move before us House File 1545 to be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. With that, Representative Hamilton, I'm still not able to officially move it, but that's going to be its destination when I do get all members present. So we'll go ahead and get started with your bill, and by the time you're done, let's hope we've got everybody so we can actually move it to Ways and Means. So with that, we'll start with testimony. Representative Hamilton, if you'll proceed with your bill, House File 1545.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. This bill, it does extend the Food Safety and Defense Task Force until June 30th of 2027, and then authorizes the Minnesota Department of Agriculture to regulate those who slaughter, process, or label domesticated animals of any size for use in human consumption. And so if you notice on lines 1.11, we do strike the word large to include small animals as well.
Representative Hamilton, that is the extent of your bill this morning?
That is the extent of the bill.
Before I go to member questions, we do have a quorum, so I will move House File 1545 before the committee to be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Member questions at this time for the bill author? And Representative Hamilton, I have one person who'd like to testify, Rachel Futholt, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Oh, I'm sorry. Your ally does not want to testify, apparently. So.
Oh, wow.
I'm disappointed. So I have no testifiers. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on House File 1545 that is before the committee at this time? Seeing no public testimony, no member questions, I will renew my motion that House File 1545 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Representative Hamilton, you are on your way, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
The next bill on the agenda is House File 1185. I did see the author, Representative Scott, was here. And as we are getting ready for Representative Scott, I will move House File 1185 before the committee to be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. And we will also take care of the minutes from yesterday's meeting. Representative Joachim, have you had a chance to review yesterday's minutes?
Mr. Chair, yes, I have.
And Representative Joachim will move the minutes from?
I will move the minutes from March 7th, 2017.
Representative Joachim moves the minutes from March 17th. Any discussion, questions? Seeing none, hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Representative Scott, to your House File 1185. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. A few weeks ago, actually the first couple weeks of session, the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee had the Records Disposition Panel come in and visit us. And for those of you that are unfamiliar, that disposition panel is kind of housed at the Historical Society, and it's when they meet, it's made up of a representative from the Attorney General's office, from the Legislative Auditor's office, and someone from the Historical Society. And what they have done is they've set out to determine how long government documents and government information should be kept. And what I would want to do first was, and by the way, that was the first time that panel had ever been sanctioned or asked to come and testify before the legislature, so it was a very enlightening discussion about records retention. And so if I think there should be in your packet this document here. It says, what is the role of the Minnesota Historical Society on the panel?
We do have that representative,
all right.
Scott.
And just the definition down there, the term state archives means those records preserved or appropriate for preservation as evidence of the organization, functions, policies, decisions, procedures, operations, or other activities of government, or because of the value of the information contained in them. So I'm just kind of setting the stage here for House File 1185. In this age of technology, government entities are trying to keep up with the changes in operations that now technology brings. And in House File 1185, we're creating a definition of correspondence so that it captures written and electronic text-based communications and is in keeping with the definition of the state archives on this document that is in your packet. The legislature needs to address this issue. Currently, there is a hodgepodge of government retention policy in relation to electronic correspondence, and there needs to be uniformity so that no entity has to guess or simply choose what works best for them. I know we all care about government accountability and transparency. Obviously, neither is possible if the records are destroyed after a short time. I'd like to draw members' attention to page 4 of the bill. If you look on page 4 of the bill, under subdivision 7, it's a reference to the records management statute. As you can see, we did make some changes in this section, but the changes are small. You can see that the records management statute has been in place for some time. In fact, I think it's been in place since the 1970s. So it says it should be the duty of the head of each state agency and the governing body of each county, municipality, and other subdivision of government to establish and maintain an active continuing program for the economical and efficient management of the records of each agency, county, municipality, and other subdivision of government. That's been law for a long time. As I said, I actually have it in my notes here, that portion of statute has been the law since 1974. And the Data Practices Act has been the law since 1979. So for over 40 years, governments have been tasked with managing data and providing government data when requested. Whether that information is in paper or electronic form, the public has a right to access it, and it is the duty of the government to provide it. Now, one of the concerns that we'll hear from opponents is storage. And I brought my props with me. This is a banker's box. This is how data used to be, correspondence, government documents used to be stored in banker's boxes. And when the basement of that facility was full, they had to rent off-site storage facilities. And when there was a data request, you had to file through these boxes and boxes of paper documents. We don't do that anymore. This is a flash drive. I looked online, and a 512 gigabyte hard drive, or 5 gigabyte flash drive, is about $20, and it holds 1 gigabyte of data. That's the equivalent of 700 floppy disks, if you remember those, or 300 songs downloaded in MP3 format. Now, I didn't make copies for y'all this time, but off the internet, this is a desktop external hard drive, and you can purchase one of these with 3 terabytes of information for $89.99, 5 terabytes of information for $123. So this is another tool for storage. Now, a five terabyte hard drive would hold about half of the print collection of the Library of Congress. And I didn't make a picture of the Library of Congress for you, but it's a big place. It holds a lot of documents. So that's how far storage has come. The other concern that governments have is the concern of data requests. Government entities can lower their costs and time regarding requests by setting up their system to separate public from not public at the front end. They can also seek out vendors with products that are designed to meet data practices, needs, and requirements. They could also place commonly requested public data on their websites. It is important for government entities to budget for records management systems as laid out in law, to comply with Records Management Statute and the Data Practices Act. Making data available to the public is part of the cost of doing business in Minnesota, and it is simply good for a government's internal operations. It is important to point out here that statute says that there's a reasonable amount of time allowed to fulfill data requests. The responsible authority should also work with the data requester to make the request as specific as possible. And requests can be done in segments to fulfill a portion of the data request at a time when these are large data requests. What I'd like to do now, Mr. Chair, is just allow some testimony. Those are kind of my opening comments, and there's some testimony here from folks that actually do this for a living in the private sector and some other entities, too, and I know there's plenty of folks in opposition to this, too.
Well, Representative Scott, thank you. I have no amendments, so we can dispense with that administrative piece of business. I do have 10 testifiers that have signed up. I'm not sure if any of these testifiers are the ones that you're referring to, but Representative Scott, do you know if your testifiers have signed up in advance, or are they a part of your presentation here this morning?
I believe so. I believe folks from NCOGI are here. I believe there's a gentleman from Entodyne and a private citizen also, Sheila Van Pelt. I'm not sure who else.
All right. Well, what I'm going to do, if you don't have anybody that you want to come to support your testimony right now, I'm just going to go to the list of people who have signed up, and then we'll take others if they want to after we're done with that first 10 that are on the list, if that works for you.
That's fine.
Representative Scott, if you would, I'm just going to ask you maybe to take the banker's box and maybe sit right across from where Representative Swazinski is. So we'll bring two testifiers up at a time in an attempt to save time for folks, and we'll just keep rotating individuals in and out from the testifying table. And that way you're close, Representative Scott, if there are any questions that come up during the testimony. Again, as I had mentioned, we have 10 individuals that have signed up. We will also be happy to hear from anybody who is not on the list. And James, who is standing down near the testifying table, is the page, and he would be happy to take your name and information and get you on the list and get you in the queue if you would like to speak on the matter before the committee. And with that, the first two testifiers that I'd like to come down, and we'll take you one at a time, Lenora Madigan and then Lori Beyer Krupinski, if I'm pronouncing that name correctly. Following those two presenters will be Mr. Keith Carlson and Mr. David Maida. So you, the last two names are in queue when we are done with the first two testifiers. Again, because we do have a robust agenda and we do have a number of testifiers on this, I'm going to ask that you keep your comments to about 2 minutes or less, and we'll help you if you think you're getting out of bounds to help you get within that time frame. Lenora.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Lori Barkopensky with the Department of Administration.
And good morning. I'm Lenora Madigan, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Administration.
Thank you. Which would you would like to go first? You're both on the list. Go ahead and identify yourself for the record against and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Lenora Madigan, Department of Administration. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on House File 1185 today. The Department of Administration and our partners in other agencies support meaningful government transparency, practices, and policies, and we take very seriously our responsibility to maintain public records as required by law. This file would dramatically expand the amount and types of data that an agency must retain in order to comply with records retention requirements outlined in Chapters 15 and 138. It could potentially diminish rather than enhance genuine transparency while straining operating costs and productivity and open and creative decision making. In an effort to help ensure the legislature and the public's expectations of government transparency, efficiency, and performance are met, and that the Department of Administration as well as other state agencies are able to comply with the law, we want to share with you today how the proposed changes will impact state agencies.
Mr. Chair, again, Lori Barkopensky. As you've already heard, the responsibilities government has to both create records and maintain them according to an approved retention schedule. The Data Practices Act also requires government to keep their records easily accessible for convenient use and provide access to members of the public and data subjects, as you've already heard. My data practices staff train people to understand their obligations, comply with the law, and follow their retention schedules. These three laws all work together and recognize that in addition to having transparency, government entity is also supposed to be a good steward of data. And you can be a good steward by securing the data that you have and by collecting and maintaining only what you need to perform your government work responsibly, effectively, efficiently. This bill removes the distinction between those official records, that smaller subset of data, and government data as it relates to correspondence. Government transparency's requirements, as Representative Scott said, has retained really the same for decades. The reality is that entities, most of the data is now kept electronically versus hard copies. A good example would be decades ago, staff would have participated in drafting a report, there would have been handwritten notes, there would have been oral discussions. Those drafts, with every wordsmithing, would not have been retained. But the research and evidence and the final report would have been what was important to keep. What we found is that the bill would require government to keep substantially more information than they do now. Beyond the fiscal impacts, this impacts operations by making it more difficult to secure data, diminishing worker productivity and effectiveness, but more importantly, increasing the amount of time it takes government to respond to data requests without improving meaningful transparency. I've got a couple examples to hopefully make this make more sense for folks. Department of Human Services gets not public data in emails during a licensing investigation. Summary of those emails is put into their complaint report, which is the official record. This bill would require Department of Human Services to keep every single email with all of that private data, even when it's copied to multiple DHS staff related to that investigation, instead of keeping that one official record. So it really expands the universe. For Department of Education, they often get requests for aggregate data that is based on individual private student data. They're going to have emails among staff with data analytics and program staff and IT about how do we produce this aggregate data without identifying students. And they'll share examples of, see, you can still tell it's Representative Pugh's child. So, you know, that's what they want to be able to have is that final product. The aggregate report is what they keep and what's public. Not all of the how did we decide to approach this task and how we did that work. From Deed, you'd have emails from customers who are interested in unemployment, services for the blind, job seekers. And at Admin, we have emails from folks, government and not, who want to have a parking contract with us. There isn't an IT tool that can review every email for not public data. I can have an email with my child's teacher that also at the end asks, how's your new baby doing, or how was your mom's knee surgery? Only people can review every email to pull them apart for that not public data.
To the testifier, over just a little bit, I'd love to give you a chance to kind of wrap your thoughts. I think I know where you're heading, but I don't want to rush you, but we do have
time limits. Hear from citizens is that it takes government too long to respond right now, and that government doesn't write down all the things we think they should write down, and this bill is not going to fix that fundamental problem. I'll now turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Madigan.
Okay, I'm sorry. I thought that the two of you were going to be on there. You're already into five-plus minutes. If you can wrap your thoughts on it again, because of the robust nature and the time limits that we need to set on the bills today. So
sure.
I'll give you a chance to put your final thoughts together.
All right, thank you. So state agencies are very interested and are required to retain this data, and we're very interested in ensuring transparency. What we're concerned about in very short order is that the legislation could really create more information for the public and not really get to that needle, the information they really want to get. And that's really what we're talking about here is how do we get the public what they need.
Thank you. I don't have any member questions at this point, but I suspect you'll be around in case we do need to recall you for member questions. Thank you again for your time and being with us this morning. The next two testifiers, Mr. Keith Carlson, if you will come down, and then again, Mr. David Maida. And then following those two gentlemen will be Mike Kiefer and Sheila Van Pelt. Good morning, gentlemen. Mr. Carlson, if you would like to go first, speak your name for the record. Who you represent, proceed with your testimony, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of 10 of the regional center, greater Minnesota counties, and 4 suburban counties here in the metropolitan area. And I believe I'm speaking on behalf of counties generally. As you've already heard, records retention policy has been a long-standing part of state law. Every governmental unit, with the exception of the courts, has a records retention policy that has been approved by the panel that's already been discussed. For counties, if you elect to do what's the model retention policy currently on the State Historical Society website, that policy in just its summary form is over 45 pages. Each of our employees have to be trained to abide by that policy as well as data practices. Our concern under the bill is the intersection between the substantial increase in the records we'd have to retain under this bill and the intersection of data practices, which applies to every piece of data we have, not only our official records. Right now, data retention or records retention is based on the content of the data, and it doesn't matter what the medium is. Despite the fact that this bill refers to correspondence, its sole objective is to force us to retain most emails. To the extent, although it says that it intends to not require us to retain spam, to the extent that that information does get past our spam filters, we would have to effectively retain it. This legislation really coincides with the recent increase we've been seeing in the frequency of data practice requests and the breadth of those requests. You'll later receive testimony about just one request that has generated over 137 documents that have to be reviewed and have the private, non-public, confidential information redacted from it. Data storage costs are a concern, but really that's the smaller concern. I don't want to minimize that, particularly for small governmental units. This will be a great challenge. But again, the big issue for us is the review and redaction requirement that, frankly, doesn't apply to businesses. I'm sure you're going to hear testimony. Representative Scott has already made reference to there are easy solutions out there for the business sector.
Mr. Carlson.
The business sector is not subject to the data practices law, as has already been indicated by Mr. Kaczynski. Mr. Chairman, the state got 5 minutes to represent local government. I appreciate some latitude.
You're already at over 3 minutes. I don't know how much more latitude that you feel you need, Mr. Carlson.
I'll complete it shortly. The issue for us, again, is review and redaction. If you were to review to eliminate the 152 pages of the current Data Practices Act that extends to the classification of various data, that it's private, confidential, non-public, we won't have an issue. But the fact is, if we disseminate this information that is private, confidential, non-public, we're subject to both civil and criminal sanctions. That's the huge concern for us. This is a huge unfunded mandate for local governments. We have asked for a local impact note. So far, we've been unsuccessful in getting the consent to do that, but this is a substantial cost to local governments as well as state agencies. I might conclude my comments at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. And I have no member questions at this time. Stay around if there are any. And we'll move now to Mr. Maeda. Welcome, sir. State your name for the record and who you represent. Proceed with your testimony, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is David Maeda. I am the city clerk for the city of Minnetonka, and I'm testifying today on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities in opposition to House Bill 1185. For the past 3 years, I've conducted an electronic records management training for the Minnesota Clerks and Finance Officers Association's Annual Conference and Clerks Institute, which is a 3-year certification program for city clerks throughout the state. The message of my training is that when it comes to records management, the format, whether it's on paper or from a computer, doesn't matter. What matters is the content. State law requires us to preserve all records necessary to a full and accurate record of our city's official activities. Records management laws and their corresponding records retention schedule balance the public's right to access government information with the maintenance and destruction of city records. The balance of these values is important. Cities currently are required by law to maintain a full and accurate record of our transactions and affairs, and our records retention schedule has 29 categories with over 700 specific records. These records need to be kept for a specified amount of time, regardless of the format. When a resident complains about a neighbor's property, that complaint, whether it comes by email or a letter, needs to be kept for 7 years. News about email retention policies make it seem like emails are deleted after all emails are deleted after some amount of time. This isn't true. Under current law, if an email is a record, it must be kept. Cities find that House File 1185 does two things. It, number one, broadly defines correspondence under records management laws, and number two, limits city discretion of what records should be destroyed. For example, the large volume of email that has no public value was highlighted in a recent data practices request our city received. I had to review 1 year's worth of email that contained certain words and phrases. We had implemented an email archiving system that kept a copy of all incoming and outgoing emails. While this system helped in searching for those words and responding to the requests, it also brought up a ton of spam and thousands of emails that clearly were transitory in nature. We are a city that's lucky to have an email archiving system in place. We only do so because we belong to LOGIS, which is a consortium of cities that allows us to purchase a product like this. One might argue this wasn't a good use of city resources, but I would also argue it was not worthwhile for the person who made the data practices request. Instead of reviewing maybe a handful of relevant emails, he had to sort through the thousands that came up through our search. When it comes to records retention, more doesn't always mean better. I'll conclude my remarks by noting my bachelor's degree is in journalism. I appreciate what Representative Scott is attempting to address and truly believe in government transparency. When our city receives a data practices request, I work with the staff to respond, and sometimes the staff person is worried about the records we're including in our response. I always tell them, however, that showing our decision-making and business activities is a good thing in maintaining our public's trust. We do our best to manage our resources wisely, and unfortunately this bill does hinder our ability to do that by requiring us to keep and then manage electronic communication that has no value to us at the city and also to our residents. Thank you for consideration of our concerns.
Mr. Beata, I'm going to ask you to hold. We do have a member question, but before we do that, to keep things moving, again, Mr. Kiefer and Ms. Van Pels will be the next two testifiers. So if they want to get come on down, we'll get you ready to go. And then we will be following that by Mr. Gambrelling, and we will also then follow by Ms. Jill Coyle. With that, we do have a question from Representative Nelson. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm just wondering here for the county and for the cities, that what kind of property tax impact would this have, having to increase storage, increase staff time to comply with this and to get the records?
Mr. Mieta.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, the biggest cost from our end is really the staff time it takes to first manage the records, and then the data practices request. It also takes a lot of time. In that, the requests I talked about, our city attorney and myself spent over a week going through each email that came out of our email archiving system to make sure there wasn't any non-public data in it. And it took two of us, two fairly high-paid city officials, to do that, and that would be the property tax impact.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative, follow-up.
So what I'm hearing him say is that there would be need more staff, especially some of the smaller cities, and would need more staff, so therefore they have to hire that staff. They'd have to raise taxes or raise revenue somehow to get that staff. So, again, that would have an impact on our local property taxes.
Statement or question, Representative Nelson?
I guess that's what he said. I think he's shaking his head.
Okay. Having no other member questions, thank you for your testimony. And Mr. Kiefer, we'll get started with you. Ms. Van Pelt, if you want to join him, and then we'll get to you. And again, following these two testifiers will be Mr. Gambrelling and Ms. Coyle. Mr. Kiefer, good morning. If you'll identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Rob. My name is Michael Kiefer. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I am here both on a professional level and a personal level. I am a citizen of the state of Minnesota, but I also work for a company based in Mendota Heights that we specialize in doing email archiving. So the type of system that the previous testifier has, we develop, maintain, sell, so I consider myself somewhat be an expert on the concept of email archiving. I did submit a document that should be in your packet that offers up a summary on kind of email archiving in general and some of the capabilities. The majority, I've been following this bill very closely, and the majority of the testimony against has been related to the cost of an email archiving system. And I have a concern that those costs may be being inflated. And on page 2 of the document I've submitted, I have included actual costs that counties in the state of Minnesota that currently use our system have paid for our system and have to pay on an annual basis to maintain it. So I think you'll see that while it is not inexpensive, it is not overly expensive either. The email archiving system in a lot of ways will greatly simplifies the task of responding to public information requests. As the previous testifier acknowledged, that they do have a single place to go look for, to find those emails, and then can search for them, narrow the field, the scope down, and then do the reviews to determine what finally has to be made public. Without a system like that, I've seen people have to go around to various users that are covered by the concern, asking them, can you provide us with the information that's covered here? So they're spending their time. If they're not being cooperative, someone else may need to go in and do that sort of search. Having an email archiving solution puts all those emails in one single location where they can easily be searched. On a personal point, my main concern would be related to transparency. Right now, the way the law is, I guess, being implemented, is it's very subjective. It's up to the user or the handler of that email to make the judgment call as to whether or not this is something that should be kept or not. In this, the scope can go beyond public record. It can just simply go to transparency to how someone is doing business. If someone is doing something that's not on the up and up, do you think they're going to keep that email? More likely they're not. And you're not going to be able to, you know, find those footprints in the sand, so to speak. If you have an email archiving solution where everything is being kept, just because it's being kept doesn't mean it's being made public. It means it's made available so that the appropriate personnel can search through them and make the determination, is this email a public document or not, and at that point make it public. I'm open to take any questions that you may have on the technology, trying to keep my comments brief here.
Mr. Kiefer, thank you for being with us and providing your testimony. I do not see any member. Oh, Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Kiefer, for being here. I appreciate your testimony. I'm looking at the back of the document where you reference the expenditures of a county, for example. And for the listening public, the numbers are really relatively low. The initial expenditure, and I do have a question, the initial expenditure that you have listed is $5,800 something, and then the annual support thereafter is the $1,100. Am I reading that correctly?
Yes.
Yes, and so Mr. Chair, Mr. Kiefer, I'm wondering if you know, obviously in hearing the concern public entities, you know, they may not have been complying with the law to the degree that, you know, the statute clearly speaks to, so there will be some ramping up. But wondering if you have any idea how much staff time may have been involved in an average county that you've serviced to get to the point where, you know, they're then able to utilize the software that your company provides.
Mr. Kiefer.
Thank you, Representative Pugh. Our software, we specialize in the solution. We've really strived to make it very easy to use, user-friendly. You can easily control who can see exactly what on the system, and sitting down in front of it, there's really no learning curve. It's very straightforward. Type in things such as the sender, the receiver information, and the specific keywords that you want to find, submit the search, and it'll give you a list of results, and then you can further refine against that list of results or whatever. So as far as training time goes, it's relatively minimal. To clarify on the costs, not sure if there was a question there or not, but to clarify on it, the initial expense is the layout for, you know, the software or the computer, and then the annual support expense is for updates and technical support if there are any issues down the road.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Seeing no other questions, Mr. Kiefer, thank you.
Thank you.
And Ms. Van Pelt, if you will introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Well, my name is Sheila Van Pelt. I'm happy to be here testifying before you wholeheartedly in support of your bill. I am pretty much what you would say a live case study. I've come to this government and working to make legislative changes for the last 5 to 6 years. And I never thought I'd be looking at data practices as being so critical. First off, these requests provide historical value. They definitely, as we all know, have transparency and accountability. It also promotes competency. How do we know how good we're doing a job unless we can go back and look at it? And sometimes, and in my case especially, you don't even know until later that you need it. And here is a prime example. This isn't to say, look at me, but this is the Star Tribune. In that article, I am trying to make legislative changes, and yes, some work did come through on this. But what it pointed out is, in that article, I was saying, did they even seriously investigate the case? And it wasn't until a year ago that I learned that the Minnesota Department of Health investigated the wrong facility. The on-site investigation, they didn't even do right. There's a lot of learning to be had with this. I've done work to try and have it for the OLA doing a program evaluation and looking at the quality of our input data. Do we get quality output data? I'm the one person that, thank God, many of you have passed your votes on this, but it was for the OLA to do a program evaluation on the Minnesota Department of Health HMO quality of care investigations. What I want to say to you is, with these data practices requests that I have right now, not knowing this needs to be in my wheelhouse, but where is it that we look for who we work for? Because right now, imagine if we didn't know about what would happen with the U.S. Bank Stadium issue. What if that data was just destroyed? And we didn't get to know. Maybe this didn't come to the surface, maybe until a year or two down the line. Where would we be? Where would our taxpayers be with this issue? They would like to know, I am sure, like many of you. We need to preserve that data. And in my case right now, with two outstanding data practices requests with the Minnesota Department of Health, I'm not even getting the commissioner and the responsible authorities to follow statutes to adhere for data on a person within 10 days. I submitted it in September. It goes unaddressed until it's revised and revamped, intentionally and purposely ignored. Within that learning that can happen is, for instance, why did they investigate the wrong facility? Why, when I show them all these multiple red flags, systemic and numerous red flags that they go ignored, that come into play with all of our investigations, I could go on. And right now I will say, with the governor's office, I respectfully look at things, but I have had a data practices request there. This fall, I was told that this person maintained that data for now 4 years. I do a data practices request, and it doesn't show up. So I am concerned not only about what is the retention that's so needed, but what are we producing? And I question, again, the previous testifier, are we operating on the up and up? Well, we have a right to access to know, again, for competency, quality. Are we doing a good job? Are we being transparent? And also with that, this, as mentioned earlier, subjective versus objective. I would have thought that there would be a dump that you pull it from, but it's subjective. A person can pull out what they want to show. Now, there are some things that I'm asking for.
Ms. Van Pelt, I'm going to ask you to wrap up. You're almost close to 3.5 minutes.
Oh, you should have cut me off.
I want you to have a fair shot at it. So if you want to take about 30 seconds to wrap your thoughts, that'd be helpful.
In summation, we have to remember who we work for. And are we making that data available to them, outlined in statutes? And are we being a good steward of the responsibilities we have to adhere to that for the public's right? Thank you.
I don't have any member questions right now, but if you want to stick around, there may be some in the future. Ms. Van Pelt, thank you for being with us today. And with that, the next two testifiers, Mr. Gamberling and Ms. Coyle, and then following that will be Mr. Rogan and Mr. Nobles. And that would conclude the list of those testifiers who have asked to be on the list in advance. Again, anyone who is here that would like to speak to the matter that hasn't had an opportunity, see James, and he will get you in queue to address the committee. And Mr. Gamberling, we will start with you. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for the correction earlier. It is Gamberling. My kids and I keep track of the interesting pronunciations of our name, and this is a new one that you came up with.
Well, this is the hardest part of the job that I have.
Oh, I know. I've done some of the same things. So, my name is Don Gamberling. I'm with the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information, which is a bunch of volunteers who try and keep government transparent and accountable. Okay? In my own personal history, I've been working with these issues since 1973. Okay? For a while, I was responsible for the statewide records management program for the state of Minnesota. And what I'd like to do is give you a complete history of all that, but I sure as heck can't do that in 2 minutes. So I'm going to give you some highlights. In 1971, if I remember right, and bear with me, the state did a study of how it was handling records management. It was done by a professional archivist. He made recommendations as to how the state ought to change what it was doing, and that produced the records management statute, which was enacted in 1974. Typically, however, of that kind of thing, it didn't get funded. Okay? It particularly didn't fund what the Department of Administration was supposed to do, which was to establish a statewide program of records management. And summarizing to the future, what that has produced is some of the testimony that you've heard today. You have varying levels of records management attention at different levels of government. Okay? Some people take it very seriously. Manabe County for years took it very seriously. Some of the associations take it very seriously and help their members. But historically, that attention and the funding has not been there. And so part of the reason why we went to Representative Scott, because we're the source of this bill, was to at least start a discussion, a meaningful discussion, of whether or not the state of Minnesota wants to preserve its history, because that's what we're really talking about here. Now, one of the things I've heard in the testimony, which I find not new to me, because more than anybody in this room, I have worked with government officials and trained them. Nobody in this room has trained more government officials on records management and data practices than I have, okay? And what I'm hearing is government wants to decide what the public has a right to get. That is not what the Data Practices Act says. You've made that very clear over the years, that the public goes in and says, I get to see what I want to see if it's public. But at least two of the previous testifiers have said, we ought to decide whether or not the request is worthy. Now, part of what's happening, in summary, is after 40 years plus of the Data Practices Act, more and more citizens are beginning to understand what the statute says. More and more citizens are beginning to understand why it's important to get access to government information, to hold government accountable. And more of those people, strangely enough, have a technology orientation. So when the government raises absolutely specious arguments about whether or not data is accessible, they are able to refute those arguments. And hopefully you will listen to the concerns of citizens such as those of Ms. Van Pelt, because we're talking about transparency and accountability here. One of my most frustrating things in my job when I used to work in the state of Minnesota,
wrap for about 3.5 minutes.
No, I'm good. Was listening to the strange and wonderful arguments advanced by government to avoid the responsibilities that you have given them under the Data Practices Act. And you're now hearing arguments of how to avoid the responsibilities you've given to them under the Records Management Statute, which has been in effect for 42 years. Thank you. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer.
Thank you, sir. I don't have any member questions at this time, but stick around. There may be something as we get to more discussion. Ms. Coyle, welcome. If you'll state your name for the record and who you represent.
Absolutely. Thank you. Cheryl Driscoll, members of the committee. Thank you for the time to speak to House File 1185. My name is Jill Coyle. I am general counsel for the Rosemont Apple Valley Egan School District, a position I've enjoyed for the past 17 years. In principle, I understand the spirit of transparency and history behind House File 1185. What I struggle with, and with all due respect to Mr. Gemberling's years of experience, is the practicality of the bill as proposed. Minnesota law currently requires government entities to develop and adopt their own records retention schedules to be approved by the state. Retention periods vary depending on the significance of the records. Currently, only records that are part of an official transaction are required to be preserved. Records that do not form an official transaction are not. Bill 1185 broadens the requirements dramatically. Under the proposed language, virtually all correspondence must be kept for 3 years, no matter how mundane, with only a few exceptions. Correspondence does not need to be part of an official transaction. The language applies to all staff members, not just officers and administrators. It applies to all types of written and electronic-based communication. Now, what I'd like you to do is to imagine what that looks like in a school district like Rosemont Apple Valley Egan, where we have 4,000 employees and 28 students, nearly all of whom use computers and cell phones on a daily basis. The concept of capturing and preserving 3 years' worth of all of those work-related emails is staggering and doesn't even take into account work-related text messages on private phones, tweets on official feeds, Facebook comments on official Facebook pages, and old-fashioned letters, all of which are arguably within the definition of correspondence in the bill. In preparation for today's testimony, I looked at the emails I received yesterday. In addition to what I'll call emails of substance in which I gave legal advice, there were a number of less substantial emails, including listservs I subscribe to, Outlook meeting requests, a Council of School Attorneys daily digest, an update to my continuing legal education credit status, a back-and-forth email with a colleague about whether or not we had the right login credentials for a federal data report. I can go on and on, but very few of those emails would rise to the level of historical significance. While it's been suggested that government entities can simply purchase an email archiving solution, there are concerns, great concerns, about that as well. First, of course, the cost, but more significantly, as has been suggested, is the time it will take to search for and sort all of those archived emails in the event of a request, which we do receive. Depending on the nature of the request and the search terms used, a spectacular number of emails may be retrieved. District staff, not the archiving solution, but district staff will then have to read all of those emails to determine, one, if they're responsive to the request that's been made, and two, whether or not private or confidential data needs to be redacted. There are a myriad forms of private data. Educational data on students will be in many of school district emails. Classified under 1332, we would have to take that out. Employee data, classified under 1343, much of that is classified as private. It would need to be redacted. Trade secret information given to us as part of a bid response would need to be redacted. Confidential data under 1339, those are all of the types of data that we deal with on a daily basis. And if we do a search for what could be thousands of emails and then work through those to sort them and redact them, those are hours of staff time that we do not have the funds to afford at this point. My position, and I believe most government entities' positions as they look at this in terms of practical realities.
We're closing in on 4 minutes, I'm going to ask you to,
okay.
to
I will wrap it up. My suggestion is to continue to keep the requirement that records must relate to an official transaction before they're required to be preserved, and to leave the proper retention periods to government entities and the state entity that reviews those retention periods. Thank you.
Ms. Coyle, thank you. And I see no member questions, but I'll give you the same advice. You might want to hang by if there are some member questions and we get a little bit further on in the hearing this morning.
Thank you again.
Is there a Dan Rogan here as well today? Dan, if you'll join Mr. Nobles, we'll have you go first, and Mr. Nobles will have you wrap up with a list of people who have already signed up. Is there anyone else from the public who would like to testify on the matter today that's before the committee? Again, if you would, see James LePage. He'll get you queued up and ready to go. Mr. Rogan, welcome. If you'll state your name and who you represent, and proceed with your testimony, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Dan Rogan. I'm the Civil Division Manager for the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, and I've been involved in Hennepin County's email management policy and responses to data practices requests for more than a decade. I'm here on behalf of Hennepin County, and we are opposed to House File 1185 for the same two reasons that you've heard from other government entities. One, we think that the definition of correspondence is too broad, way too broad. And two, we believe that the three-year time period is too long. If this bill becomes law, it will result in local government spending a huge amount of taxpayer money to store, search, review, and produce endless irrelevant and unimportant and duplicative electronic files. We think that a more narrowly tailored bill or the current law is sufficient. Because of the testimony that others have had, I will just kind of highlight a couple of things that I think to add to the discussion. I think that the by expanding the retention requirement beyond materials that are an official transaction or data that is the document official actions, the number and type of emails that must be kept is hard to define, but it appears to be extremely broad. And for Hennepin County, that's an enormous cost. With 9,000 employees, we currently have on our email system 200 million emails. And that involves right now employees routinely deleting irrelevant emails on a daily basis. This would dramatically expand that, and I don't know what how many hundreds of millions it would go up to, but it would dramatically expand the number of emails that Hennepin County would need to keep for up to 3 years. And the cost of that is threefold. One, there's an increased risk of this data being on the email system, of it being a private and confidential data being subject to cyber phishing. As many of you have heard, there's one of the easiest ways to get into a network is through the email system. And forcing government to keep private and confidential data on the email system increases the risk that that data is going to be subject to a cyber attack. Second, we talked a little bit about the increased cost of storage. And I'm not going to go into that. There are many different ways that counties can do that. Hennepin County doesn't have a separate system. It keeps it on its own system. But there are significant costs when you dramatically increase the millions of emails that are going to be kept. And third and most importantly is what we've talked about is the cost of responding to really broad data practices requests. That's really a separate problem that I think this committee or others should look at about how to narrow some of the data practices requests that come in. But by dramatically increasing the number of emails that are going to be required to be kept, it's going to dramatically increase the cost associated with that. I've personally been involved in many requests where I have sat down with, including one for the Sheriff Stanek's office, where I sat down with numerous members of his command staff to go over their emails so that I could make sure that we were not going to disclose personal, confidential, or private emails. And as you all well know, the Data Practices Act has many different permutations about when something is private or confidential, and you really need an expert in the room, usually an attorney, and you need a subject matter expert on what the data is to be able to go through it. And so the cost associated with going with these large requests is only going to get much more significant under this bill. So for those reasons, we're opposed to the bill. Thank you, Mr.
Rogan. Thank you. I don't have any member questions at this time. Give you the same advice, Hang, in case there are other questions as the committee starts to debate the bill. And Mr. Nobles, if you will identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and I would like to just read to you what is the current law, and it's been referred to. I think you need to keep it in mind as you listen to this testimony about decisions that are made internally within agencies and organizations as to whether or not they keep certain records. This is current law, that a public official shall make and preserve all government records necessary to a full and accurate knowledge of their official activities. Do you think that some of the emails that have been deleted might have given a citizen or you or the legislative auditor a full and accurate understanding of an official government activity? Possibly. But again, as Mr. Gimmerling said, right now that is fully within the discretion of agency officials. So the bill before you clears up where email fits into those decisions. For example, and I just want to be clear, because I think it's been raised before in another committee, that the legislature is considering this legislation without being subject to the Government Data Practices Act. My office, the Office of Legislative Auditor, is subject to the Government Data Practices Act, has been for years. We receive many requests for data. We have to segregate, delete, redact classified data, determine the classification, and then fulfill a data practices request by providing the public with what is public. Does it take time? Yes, it does. But it's part of our responsibility as public officials and public employees. It's part of our service to the public to be open and transparent and accountable. So might this bill expand that sum? Possibly. But again, it is in the interest of accountability, transparency, and openness. It will also serve, frankly, the needs of the Office of the Legislative Auditor when we go and examine the activities that you want us to examine within an executive agency or even within a local unit of government. And so for that reason, I have felt comfortable with this. What I would finally say, though, it is a little bit disappointing that we only hear opposition and no specifics as to how those who declare their allegiance to openness and transparency would come forth with legislation that would clarify the place of these emails in existing law to keep and preserve a record that will tell the public, tell legislators, tell others the full and accurate understanding of what those actions have been. So, Mr. Chair, that's my testimony.
Mr. Nobles, thank you for your testimony. We do have one member question that I'm aware of at this time. Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nobles, in all of the research you've done, do you see, is there a certain percentage of abuse or retaliation member, people request making these requests on retaliation basis, and what is it?
Mr. Nobles.
Mr. Chair, members, I do have a lot of citizens who come to me who have tried to get data from government organizations, be they state agencies, the university, many others, and express the same frustration that Ms. Van Pelt expressed. She is but one example of many citizens who come to the legislative auditor out of frustration that the doors have been closed to them to get access to data they thought, as a citizen, they had a right to see.
Representative Fenton, follow-up?
No follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nobles.
Mr. Nobles, I don't see any other member questions, but we'll ask you to stand by in case there is something as we continue our deliberations. That does conclude the list of those testifiers who had signed up in advance, and as I've been encouraging, if you did want to speak to this matter, to get with James. I see no one else from the public coming forward. So with that, we will move to Representative Scott, give you a chance to kind of react to some of the things, and then we'll have some member discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for all of the folks that testified for and against the bill. It's always good to have a public discussion of policy. I want to respond just, maybe I'll just hit these, not necessarily in any order, but just some notes that I've taken. The records dispensation panel, if you look at their 100-and-some-odd page document, they require for paper correspondence a retention period of 3 years. That's where, that's how I arrived at the 3 years retention. If it's good enough to keep in a box like that that you have to sort through, then it should be okay to have it electronically stored in the same fashion. The other thing that I want to note is that in statute, there is no definition for official records. That is up to it's very vague, and it's in the eye of the beholder. So any individual or government employee can determine for themselves what is official under current law, because there is no definition. That's one of the reasons for the bill changes that I've made. As far as I've heard over and over again about the difficulty and the man hours that it takes to fulfill a data request. And there's no question that that can be a timely endeavor. I'm not saying that it's not. But again, you work with the person requesting. You tell them that this is a large request. This is going to take me estimated X amount of hours, days, weeks, months. And you work with the requester. Someone coming in and asking for a large request cannot be expecting the government entity to fulfill that request in a matter of days. It's just not humanly possible. I think that one of the status quo and the way things are being done now is always hard to change. But as we heard from just even one private sector vendor, there are such great advancements in technology as far as indexing emails coming and going. Once an email is captured into their system, it's searchable within minutes. And if you're doing a data request now, these government entities, and they have to, as the person from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office said, you have to sit down with someone that understands the law. You have to do that now. You have to do that now. So that is not going to change. Minnesota has a rich history in government transparency. The Data Practices Act is like no other in the country. Deleting email that could be valuable later in an investigation that supports a fired government employee.
or an investigation for something like the 35W bridge collapse. This is all important information to keep and to build the public trust. And I want to also say, and when I mentioned that there's a hodgepodge of policy out there, the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office is deleting email after 30 days at the will of their employees. It's up to them to define what they think is or is not official to keep. So, members, I would just ask for your support on this bill as it moves, and if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Representative Scott, thank you. I don't have any member questions in queue right now. Are there member questions? Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott. I agree this is an important conversation to be having. Do you have any response to the unfunded mandate issue? I think it's interesting that we heard testimony that one of the challenges to the original data retention bill that was passed in the 70s was lack of funding, and that really led to a lack of agencies being able to comply. And so I don't think that there's any funding attached to your bill. And when we look at unfunded mandates for our government, we know that with local government that ends up on the backs of our local taxpayers. Is there any thought about giving some financial support to this expansion?
Representative Halverson, before I ask Representative Scott to answer that question, this is being referred to the Committee on State Government Finance, so I suspect that there will be some conversation at that point, but I'll defer to the bill author.
Thank you. Quickly, Mr. Chair, thank you, and thank you for the question, Representative Halverson. If you look at the Intradyne document, on the back side, it shows what some of the costs are. I contacted my own county. They're spending way more than this now. This could be a cost savings for a lot of local entities that aren't doing it, the right way. And my question is, these two pieces of law, the Data Practices Act and the Government Management Statute, have been in law since the 1970s. And if there's an added cost to doing this, I guess we'll be finding out in the future. But I think that we're going to find out that there's cost savings in the long run to bring entities up to what they need to be doing to fulfill law now.
Representative Halverson, follow-up. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm kind of torn on this because I've asked for information at times and been stonewalled and then gotten it begrudgingly from it in the past. So I understand that side of it where people want information. I've also seen huge data requests that people have asked for and then never show up to get it. So, I mean, I can see that other side of that. And we talk here about technology is going to fix this, but technology costs money. You know, as we found out from our Driver's License Bureau and them upgrading their computers, when you let government at times doesn't want to spend money to keep their technology up to date, so you got a 40-year-old system, can't do what modern computers and modern systems can do. So, I mean, there's going to be a cost to this, and it's to comply with the law, we have to do it. We're going to have to make sure this gets funded, and that's why I asked the question about property taxes. If we're putting it on local government officials, their only means of raising taxes is property tax, and when they raise their property taxes to pay for the equipment they need to store this stuff, we got to make sure that we're not screaming at them because they're doing it. They're doing what we're telling them to do, and I guess that's more of a statement than a question.
Representative Scott, if you want to respond quickly, I don't
really
have any other member
really
questions.
Quickly. The other resource that all state and local units of government, including government agencies, has is Minute, and Minute helps local units of government, if they ask for it, to set up systems, give them advice, best practices, those sorts of things. But that's my only comment right now.
Representative Scott, we don't have any other member questions. I realize and I concur with Representative Nelson that this is an issue that needs some more looking at, and I appreciate you taking this on this year. I think you also agree that you don't have the perfect solution, but you are working to that end, and so I compliment you, Chair Scott, for taking that on and keeping in mind the people and the needs of government and the people in this. So with no other member questions, I will renew my motion that House File 1185 be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? No. Representative Chair Scott, you are on your way.
Thank you very much for your time.
Members, some housekeeping things for you. We do have some bills that do take some time today. That's one of the reasons why I have a fewer number of bills, but they do take more time. For member planning, we will be reconvening tonight in the basement hearing room where we are right now at 7:30 or the call of the chair, so just prepare accordingly for that if we don't get done with our course of business for today. With that, I'm going to invite Chair Fabian to come forward. We'll take his bill, House File 1291, and as Representative Fabian is making his way forward, I will move that House File 1291 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Chair Fabian, welcome to the committee. If you will proceed with presenting your bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1291 is kind of a continuation of a process that I got involved in 2011 in my first term, and that's trying to react to the concerns of local governments and businesses that get caught in a difficult situation trying to get environmental review and permitting done. The number of individuals and representatives that come into my office and pick up the phone call and send emails is really quite large with regards to their frustration trying to navigate through this process. And, you know, as I've said before, I know sometimes some of these things are a little controversial, but I don't sit around in my office, you know, dreaming up the language that necessarily goes into these bills. What I do is react to the concerns that my constituents and others around the state express to me about the process that they're trying to go through, trying to be good communities and good businesses, trying to get through this process to make sure that we do protect the air, land, and the water, but at the same time also get through this process so it doesn't take up so much time and so much money. So this bill is another step in that process. And I want to emphasize to the members and everybody else who's here that we are not lowering any environmental standards and are not removing any public comment with regards to permitting and environmental review. We are simply trying to react and make this smoother for businesses and communities to go through. The governor has said a number of times that he's interested in seeing this permitting process expedited, move at the speed of commerce and business, and we're trying to nudge this along by doing this. Mr. Chair, I'm not 100% certain which sections of the bill you want to hear. I assume it has something to do with sections 4 and 10. With the unadopted rules, but I'll leave that to
what Mr. Representative Fabian. What I'm going to do is I'm going to ask Mr. Gehring to identify for the committee the areas that are within the purview of this committee. It is a rather robust bill, but we will hear from Mr. Gehring. So I'm going to ask members and testifiers to keep their questions and comments and concerns to those sections of the bill. Mr. Gehring.
So, Mr. Chair and committee members, Representative Fabian has already sort of described what the bill does. The government operations jurisdiction in this bill would be Article 1, Sections 4, 5, and 10 all relate to unadopted rules and some administrative process related to environmental permitting. And then in Article 2, there's the general kind of elimination of the EQB and transfer of that authority to other government entities also is within the general purview of this committee. But I'd specifically point to Section 11, which relates to rulemaking that's being transferred to the PCA. Section 13 provides for temporary advisory boards to review some permitting decisions. And then Section 40 is the actual transfer of legal authority to the new entities.
Representative Fabian, did you have a testifier that wanted to speak before we take the those who have signed up?
Sure, that would be good.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Corliss. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And, Mr. Chairman, I will be brief. I'm sure there are some folks.
Brevity is
greatly other things to do at 7:30 this evening, but this has been an important issue for the Chamber since 2009. We have been working in a bipartisan fashion with the Dayton administration, as Representative Fabian has said, to get the regulatory agencies to operate at the speed of commerce. It's important to us. We've heard from our members in various venues that time, costs, and uncertainty are factors that are very important as they make to look to either locate or expand here in Minnesota. So it's important for economic development projects. Mr. Chairman, I will be around to answer any questions, and I know you've got some other people that need to testify.
Thank you. And that concludes the setup by Representative Fabian, and I have two testifiers that have signed up. I'll ask them both to come down, Mr. Suford and Ms. Fihaki, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. I'll ask you to make your way here. Sir, good morning, and welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Will Seufert, pronounced like soy sauce. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Environmental Quality Board. I will be brief with my comments. My comments will pertain to Article 2 of the bill, which is a wholesale elimination of the Environmental Quality Board. We had a pretty robust discussion about this last week in committee, so I won't bore you with a replay of that. But I do want to acknowledge that the board for 44 years has been providing a platform for interagency coordination on large environmental issues that cut across multiple agency jurisdictions. And it's also provided a public forum, as it is made up of nine state agency heads and five citizen members. So we feel passing Article 2 is a step backwards for both public participation as well as interagency coordination. One thing in particular, though, I do want to speak to, which I think is of interest to this committee, pertains to the transfer of rulemaking and the administration of the Environmental Review Program. The way Article 2 is structured, it both repeals the board but also transfers some of our duties to other agencies. Currently, the EQB administers the Environmental Review Program statewide. So environmental reviews are done primarily by cities and counties and also state agencies, but the rulemaking for the program and the administration of the program rests with the EQB. And when I say administration of the program, I'm talking about providing technical assistance to those who are performing environmental reviews, but I'm also talking about redesignating in certain cases, moving environmental review from one agency to another, resolving cost disputes, processing variance requests, things that are largely an independent function. What this bill is doing is it's transferring those to the MPCA, and essentially, that's creating a potential situation where the MPCA might be overseeing a conflict that it's also involved in, a citizen petition or a question pertaining to another agency's environmental review. The MPCA now has authority over. So we just wanted to highlight for this committee. But that concludes my comments. Other state agencies are available if there are questions pertaining to Article 1. But in the interest of time, I think I'll conclude my comments.
Mr. Seufert, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Mr.
We do have one member question. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Seufert, do you have the history of the EQB? And I know that it's been moved around lately.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'll give you some history. I mean, the EQB has evolved quite a bit over 44 years. It was created with the passage of the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act in 1973, but I think the question you're getting at is most recently, in 2011, the administration of the EQB, the few staff that remained were moved from the Department of Administration to the Pollution Control Agency, and the reason was to find some administrative efficiency. At the time, the state was dealing with persistent budget deficits, and the EQB was previously housed in the state planning agency, which was eliminated during that cycle of budget deficits. However, the EQB was considered through all those years as a real asset to the environment and to the public, so the actual structure of the board remained. And the change in 2011 simply moved the staff from admin to the PCA, and really the idea was to gain efficiency and also be closer to the subject matter experts at the PCA, DNR, and Bowser that we work with on a day-to-day basis. I hope that makes some follow-up.
Thank you. Definitely. I definitely would oppose doing away with the EQB. And at one point, as he mentioned, there used to be a state planning agency. We no longer have that. And at one point, there used to be 35 people, at least, in the EQB to do all the work that needs to be done When it was transferred over a few years ago, there were three people remaining. So we've done a real disservice to the state, in my mind, with the way we have tried to dismantle the EQB. I would like it. Actually, we were trying a few years ago. I was trying to get a bigger planning agency in the state, so we do have some consistency in the way we're moving our programs forward.
Thank you, Representative Mason. I don't see another member questions at this time. Mr. Seifert, if you want to just hang close, we may refer back to you when we get into discussions of the committee. And we'll take our next testifier. Good morning and welcome. State your name for the record, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Laylee Fadahi, and I represent Friends of the Mississippi River, a leading citizen-based organization that works to protect and enhance the Mississippi River and its watershed. Thank you for this opportunity to testify about our concerns regarding House File 1291. I will limit my comments to the sections that you identified, though I will express a bit of disappointment as there seem to be a number of other provisions in the bill that do implicate administrative process and the function of how the government operates, including between different branches of government. Sticking to first sections, 4 and 10 of Article 1, this is the section that prohibits agencies from using unadopted rules. In one respect, these sections are duplicative and unnecessary as agencies are already prohibited from using unadopted rules, and if they do so, can be legally challenged and those rules can be overturned. However, what this bill does is it changes the presumption as to whether a rule is unadopted. Under the status quo, the burden rests with the person bringing the challenge to demonstrate that there is an unadopted rule that the agency is using. This bill shifts the burden to the agency to demonstrate that it is not using an unadopted rule. The overall effect of this, much like other things in this bill and in related bills, is to make it, again, easier for regulated entities to challenge agency decisions and to tie the agency up in court, proving over and over and over again that a rule is a rule and something that is not a rule is not a rule. Keeping in mind that a lot of things that agencies use do not have the force of law, and those are the very same mechanisms that allow for the kind of flexible solutions that we hear regulated entities are interested in, the non-one-size-fits-all type of things come from things that are not rules. Moving on to Article 2, the elimination of the EQB. A major issue that we have with Article 2 is that there's really no justification that has been provided for it. As you've heard, you know, the function of the EQB is twofold. One is to provide interagency coordination around environmental issues that cross multiple agency jurisdictions. And we know these issues are often quite complex and bear impact on the jurisdictions of multiple different bodies. But the other function is also to provide opportunities for public access and engagement in these areas. The proponents of this bill have neither claimed that the EQB is failing in carrying out these functions nor offered any means by which to carry out these functions better, which leads us to conclude nothing less than this is just opposition to effective agency coordination and opposition to public access and engagement, especially as these functions are being shifted to agencies where there are multiple bills that then affect how those agencies also provide for public access and transparency and accountability. This comes as a little surprise on the heels of the demise of the MPCA Citizens Board, for example, which had gone a significant study and review by the EQB that had reached the conclusion that the Citizens Board was vital and that it needed to be strengthened rather than eliminated. And so, this is increasingly seeming as though, you know, there's some targeting of those areas that the proponents of this bill are targeting those aspects of environmental review and permitting that give the public voice and allow for regulations to happen in an efficient way and that provide a venue for decision makers to reach sound and defensible regulatory decisions. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't have any member questions. We'll just ask you to hang by in case there is anything that comes up in discussion among the committee. Is there anyone from the public or others here today who would like to testify on the matter before the committee? House File 1291. House File 1291. Seeing none and hearing none, member questions for the bill author. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I have a quick question, and it's just trying to understand in Article 2, Section 11, and maybe this would be to Mr. Gehring. In the stricken language on 22.15, getting rid of the word promulgate, but then adding the word adopt, does that mean an agency could not be directing? Does it take away the agency's ability to be flexible and create rules, then go to the legislature to have them adopted and specifically state that only the legislature can direct them to what kind of rules they can even work on?
Mr. Gehring, do you understand?
I'm just trying to understand the difference between promulgate and adopt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joachim, I'm not sure if there's intended to be a substantive difference in those two terms. Sometimes in older kind of administrative rulemaking language, you see the word promulgate. I think the more modern use is adopt. So I would read this as requiring the PCA to adopt rules in the same way that the board has done previously.
Okay.
Representative Joachim, follow up?
No, I just wanted to check. Thanks.
Seeing no other member questions, Representative Fabian, we'll give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. This is, again, I want to repeat what I said before. You know, sometimes the regulated entities, they're not businesses all the time. They are cities and counties who are struggling with the cost of environmental review for a lot of different projects that they may have. In 2011, when we had House File 1, that we had broad bipartisan support on and Governor Dayton signed, we heard a lot of the same arguments against that we're hearing today. I don't have any intention to reduce public comment. I don't have any intention to reduce standards. We simply want to continue the move forward to try to help cities and counties and businesses get through this process quicker. And I think by streamlining it, making it more compact, we can continue to move forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fabian, Chair Fabian, thank you for that. All those, I will renew my motion that House File 1291 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. You are on your way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
The next bill that we'll be taking, we have two of them by Representative Chair Erickson, and I will take House File 1826 first because we do have a few individuals who had signed up to testify, and we will have that hard break at noon because session does start at 12:15, so I want to try to inconvenience the fewest number of people that I possibly can. So with that, Representative Erickson, I will move House File 1826 to be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. And with that, Representative Erickson, if you want to proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This House file is a clone of House File 1825, which is the closing of Purpich Center for Arts Education, creating a position within the Department of Education, planning for the conveyance of the Purpich Arts High School and Crosswinds Arts and Science School, and amending a few other chapters. But I believe Mr. Gehring, or I guess it would be another House researcher,
Ms. Dyson,
who would tell us, yes, Ms. Dyson, which section we should be looking at. I believe it would be Section 8.
As Ms. Dyson is kind of settling in, because this committee does have broad jurisdiction, the testifiers that have signed up in advance, and I'll just ask them to make their way to the testifying area, and we'll get you in to testify. Benjamin Vander Kuh, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. You are here. Perfect. Ara Silky Jones, and then Mary Schaefel, if I've got that correct as well. So, again, we'll have folks here. And Ms. Dyson, did you need one more time, or are we good to identify the purview of the committee?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the bill is a proposal to close a state agency. So I would assume that all of the bill relates to the jurisdiction of the committee. There is, in particular, in the last section of the bill, relating to the closure and what would happen to each of the assets in the student enrollment. And I would assume that the provisions specific to the students and the educational provisions would not be within the purview of this committee.
Very good. Chair Erickson, with that, if you'll want to make any other additional comments before we open up to discussion and test affairs.
Mr. Chair, I do want the committee to know, and you as well, that this is a conversation that we started with the introduction of 1825. 1826 is here, so that we would have followed the process as this bill moves forward in the Committee on Education Finance. So I am certainly here to hear concerns as we move forward with several options. This is a result of this bill is a result of an extensive audit that was prepared by the Office of the Legislative Auditor and given to the legislature, in particular the education committees, just a couple of weeks ago. And the same is true of an evaluation of the financial position of the Purpose Center for Arts Education. So two very comprehensive reports, Mr. Chair and Committee, that really brought about the decision to begin the conversation by being the most bold, and that was by taking one of the recommendations from the audit, and that was to close this school that's been in, creation and operation since the late 80s, named, of course, in honor of the late and former governor, Rudy Perpich, and also his wife, Lola. So it has great historical presence in our state, but we have found through the audit that perhaps it is no longer serving the purpose that both former and late Governor Rudy Perpich and his wife Lola had in mind, since times have changed and a lot of years have transpired. And the enrollment has declined at the center, and the operation of Crosswinds, which was conveyed in 2013, has not worked as well as we would expect. So we have based our decision to move boldly as our first step in closing as a way of getting this conversation going.
Chair Erickson, did you have any testifiers?
I have Christina Pera from Nonpartisan House Research to answer any questions that might be of particular interest and concern.
Very good. Well, we will have her in queue if we need to answer any questions. And our first testifier, Benjamin Vander Coy. Thank you, sir. Welcome to the committee. Though, state your name, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, Ben Vander Coy. I'm the volunteer board chair of the Perpich Center for the Arts. I have been for just about a month. So I will talk a bit about that process very quickly because I know you don't have much time. Let me start this way. When I got on the board, the audit process was underway, and frankly, we awaited that with great anticipation. And when it did come in, we were disappointed at the level that the agency had gone to, but frankly, it was not that surprised. Because, frankly, I got on this board to find out what was going on at Perpich and to take appropriate action. Fortunately for us, now we have a roadmap on how to change things at Perpich. I want to give you a quick update on that and talk specifically about Crosswinds, because that's a major concern of ours. First, in regard to the executive director, the former executive director chose to retire effective January 2, and I think that was probably the right choice given the findings in the audit. We have now hired an interim executive director who's doing a great job, and we have an executive director search process that is underway. The 17th of March will be the end of that process, at least the application process. As of now, we have 17 applications. I know from looking at them, we have several highly qualified individuals, including a couple of school superintendents who are fully licensed in the state of Minnesota and hold PhD degrees. I guess I was surprised at that, given the kind of negative publicity we've had. The point is there's interest in the Perpich Center for the Arts, so we hope to hire a new executive director to be in place by July 1st. Second, the board really took control after getting the majority on January 11th. And at that point, we held our annual meeting. I was elected chair, and we have already instituted a number of the provisions of the audit. We've created two new committees. We have a very aggressive schedule going forward on addressing each of those concerns. Each one of those recommendations will be addressed by a separate committee. And we anticipate that process will probably take a few months, but we're hopeful when the new executive director is in place, we can have our strategic planning retreat in July and implement those recommendations. So we're moving on that front. But frankly, the last piece, and this is the one the auditor really highlighted, was the Crosswind School for Arts and Science in Woodbury. And we understand, after looking at that situation, I appointed a task force. We acted very quickly, had community meetings, talked to a number of stakeholders, and decided, frankly, that the best solution would be to act quickly, we hope by June 30 of this year, to transfer the school to another district. And, in fact, we have a proposal. It's in front of you, attached for a resolution from the St. Paul Public School System. They're excited about the opportunity to continue the program under their auspices, and they would like to do it as soon as possible so that we can retain the students, the faculty, and keep the community involved as well. So I believe that there's talk about moving this into next year. We will operate the school if we need to, but we think it's better for all parties concerned to follow the recommendation of the auditor and to have this done quickly by the end of this fiscal year, by June 30 of 2017.
Sir, yes. Oh, I'm sorry.
That's it, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Sir, thank you for your testimony. I don't have any member. Oh, I do have a member question. Representative Benton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see the proposal here from St. Paul Public Schools. Is that correct? So this school does sit within the school district in which I represent, District 833. Did you ever reach out to them to offer them to provide a proposal or their intent to possibly work to have a similar program or keep this program in the school and take it over?
Mr. Vanderkoy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. I sent email invitations to the superintendent, Dr. Keith Jacobus, on two occasions, informing him of the process. I personally spoke with him and encouraged him to present a proposal. He said his board chose not to. So we thought that was a natural choice as well. But South Washington at this point is not expressed an interest in participating in the process.
Representative Fenton, follow-up?
Not at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Oh, Representative Sandstead.
Actually, I have a statement, Mr. Chair. I can't support this bill. I left the classroom 10 weeks ago, and I'm a public school teacher that believes every student has the right to succeed. Just Monday of this week, myself, Representative Nash, Representative Loon, and others authored a bill implementing a pilot program for students in the vocational track, because we recognize that not every single student fits in the traditional classroom and excels there. I feel very strongly that the Purpich Center is there for students who excel in the arts, and they deserve that opportunity. As a teacher, when one student misbehaves, you address the student, you don't punish the entire classroom. And I feel this bill is throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Rather than addressing the issues of maybe a lack of oversight or mismanagement of the board, you're abolishing a program. And ultimately, the trickle-down is that impacts the students who are not accountable for some of their lack of oversight. I think the right solution is to get back on track, to start putting the right people on the board and following through. If I understand, you've really only been in your position for less than a couple of months. There's not enough time. To me, this is a knee-jerk reaction. This is a knee-jerk reaction rather than a well-thought-out process. I would like to see a little more time given and a study done to see if it's effective at the end. There are other audit reports that have found agencies to be ineffective. The IRRB is one of them. So we have a bill to reform the board or the agency. We have a bill to fix the problem, not to abolish the agency, not to do away with. And I know you have a piece in there that really allows for the outreach and the training opportunities, and I applaud that. But there are so many things that are good with the Purpich Center of the Arts. I cannot be more passionate about this. I really feel this is a knee-jerk reaction that is going to impact the students rather than a well-thought-out process.
Representative Freiberg, question to the testifier.
Yes.
And just before you get started, my hope is to not inconvenience the other two or three plus public testimony, because we will be stopping at noon
sure. In
order to be able to go two sessions. So I don't want to have to bring people back this evening to provide their 2 or 3 minutes for the testimony. So just asking members to manage accordingly. Representative Freiberg.
I understand. And, thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with what Representative Sands had put very eloquently. I'll save my overall remarks until the end of the discussion. I know one of the issues that the legislative auditor identified is just the fact that that the student body is not representative, it was previously, but the last couple of years it hasn't really been representative of the state of the whole. So my question for Mr. Vanderkoy is just, where are you from?
Mr. Vanderkoy.
Mr. Chair, I'm from Laverne, Minnesota, which is 240 miles away. And as a volunteer, I'm willing to make that commitment to come with, frankly, very little compensation, because I believe strongly that Greater Minnesota, where I live, needs to have these services available. And frankly, although I dealt mainly with crosswinds, let me just quickly add, we do have the school principal here from the Arts High School to talk about the positive things that are happening in Purpich and outreach. But one of the things that really I'm upset about is that outreach has been pulled back. And for lots of reasons, frankly, the resources were transferred over to Crosswinds, which was not a good idea. And I'm the first one to admit that. The auditor is right about that. But we think there's a chance here to build up the outreach again, to get the specialists to the outstate Minnesota. We have one. We should have four. And frankly, to develop other programs that will reach all corners of the state. So I am fully committed to that, based especially on where I live.
With that, I don't have any other member questions. I'll ask Ms. Ara Silkey-Jones to come forward, and then followed by our final testifier who has signed up, Mary Scheffel. Welcome to the committee. You'll state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Ahava Silkey-Jones. I'm with the Purpich Center for Arts Education. Mr. Chair, esteemed members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. I am the new principal for the Purpich Arts High School, and I'm from Northfield, Minnesota. I come to Purpich with over 10 years of experience in both school leadership and the arts and education. I came to Purpich because I am confident that with the continued investment, it can and will fulfill its mission. I see no question that Purpich continues to have relevance and impact in the state of Minnesota. In the past week, I have received over 300 impact statements from stakeholders statewide who have either been shaped by the Purpich Center over our 32-year history, or prospective families concerned about the opportunity for their children to attend the arts high school in the future. The school has taken seriously the findings in the programmatic audit, implementing immediate oversight in relation to student absenteeism, testing procedures, and a school-wide analysis of the comprehensive programming we offer, which currently accounts for the per-pupil spending. We are addressing these concerns and revitalizing our recruitment efforts. We continue to attract passionate and talented students from around the state. We have already yielded a 900% increase in student applications from Congressional District 7, which you'll see in the report has zero representation, and we have had one of Purpich's highest all-time attendance rates at recent information sessions. We are also hosting a summer camp this year for students in grades 8 through 12 to plant the seed of Purpich in the hearts and minds of the next generation. The arts represent a $2 billion footprint statewide, and the Purpich Center is a core tangible commitment by the state of Minnesota to prioritize not only the compilation and dissemination of best practices, but to take ownership over the most effective and advanced training in the arts. The challenges we currently face have not rendered this institution obsolete, but rather invaluable. In the absence of Purpich, many young artists are relegated to the periphery in their schools and never allowed to see their gifts flourish. We all lose when that happens. Purpich and Purpich alone does that. It brings artists and teachers together from around the state so they can learn from and with one another. Minnesota artists volunteer at a rate of 3 times the state average, and these artists recraft the communities in which we live. Graduates of Purpich are state and nationally recognized. Purpich students have over 97 Scholastic Arts and Writing Awards this year, with 27 of them going on to national competitions. The one thing that makes all Purpich graduates stand out is that they name Purpich as a determining factor in their success. Our outreach work has expanded to include regional centers, a turnaround arts program, nationally recognized effort to help low-achieving schools, and a statewide arts integration network. A comprehensive closure of the Purpich Center would have a catastrophic impact. Purpich is much more than a school or outreach provider. Purpich is an identity, a dream. Purpich is quite literally a lifesaver. The center has had an undeniable impact on tens of thousands of students, thousands of teachers over three decades. And Purpich may have struggled recently, but Purpich is not lost. We are ready to evolve, grow, and invest in the aspects of our work that are having the most impact and fulfill our mission in serving all students within greater Minnesota. Purpich is not a part of some of us, but rather a part of all of us. Thank you.
With that, I have one member question, Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Yes. Chair. How many principals does Purpich School have? How many total?
Representative, we have one principal at the Arts High School and a principal at Crosslands currently.
Okay, so...
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. According to the OLA report, there is at least one unlicensed principal. Is that correct?
Representative, currently there are licensed principals at both schools. Currently, yes.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So nobody currently is serving in the role that is unlicensed.
Representative, so that is correct.
Thank you.
And with that, I don't see any other testifier or member questions. With that, we have one other testifier, and I'd like to take her testimony. And then also, so thank you. And if you want to come in, Ms. Schaefel, we'll hear your testimony. And then we'll see if there's any other public testimony this evening.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is anyone else wishing to testify on the matter before the committee after Ms. Schaefel? Welcome to the committee. We'll have you state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll and members of the committee. I'll work to get this in quickly so you can move to your next obligations. I am Mary Schaefel, the Executive Director for the Minnesota Music Educators Association. Our organization works to ensure high-quality music education for every student in Minnesota, and we work in collaboration with arts education organizations in dance, media arts, theater, and visual arts. There have been questions about whether this agency is still needed, and I am here to answer with a strong yes. While school districts provide teacher workshops, nearly all music educators, 93% of them, stated they don't receive any content-specific professional development in their district. Conversations with visual art colleagues echo the same thing. Some professional development should be across all staff and all in the school. But it is also clear that teachers in small engines, history, health education, and music have different needs. In addition, our organization regularly receives inquiries from administrators and teachers about many aspects of Minnesota law and arts education. Unfortunately, Purpich staffing related to outreach changed over the last 5 years, and most of the positions have been eliminated. We used to be able to refer questions to Purpich Center and are no longer able to do so. I've also heard questioning of the Purpich Center business model. I'm here to tell you that the model delivers when it is functioning and well managed. If we look back, the Purpich Center had vibrant partnerships. Purpich staff and clinicians could serve 600 to 750 music teachers in one weekend. There are examples like that in all arts areas. When the legislature required that all academic areas include the contributions of Minnesota's American Indian tribes and communities, it was Purpich that led all of us. Purpich connected with Native American nations, identified an Anishinaabe musician and educator at the Fond du Lac Tribal College, Liz Jocula, and worked with her to create curriculum and deliver training and workshops across our state. The legislation creates a single position within the Minnesota Department of Education to serve 5 arts academic areas and almost 20 licensure assignments. That one person is required to do a number of things, which I won't list here. With deep respect to this legislative process and to your work, the way to achieve your stated goals and the way to achieve that work is to allow the new Purpich leadership to address the issues raised in the audit. We ask that you support the Purpich Center Board's plan and give them a chance to turn the agency around. and show that they can demonstrate the benefit of the Purpose Center to all students, schools, communities, and to the entire state of Minnesota.
Ms. Schaefel, thank you so much for your thoughtful comments today. Are there member questions for Ms. Schaefel? If not, we will be recessing until 6:30. We may be able to, both caucuses, both the Democrats and the Republicans use Wednesday nights for caucusing. We could be able to get together as early as 6:30. Watch your email or the call of the chair. And we'll take up amendments and committee discussion at that time. So at this time, we stand in recess. I will reconvene the March 8th meeting of the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee. When we recessed this morning, we had just finished with testimony on House File 1826, and we were going to be hearing from the bill author on a couple of other items, and then we also have the DE1 amendment that's going to be offered, and then a member discussion to wrap this bill up. In the interest of time, Representative Erickson, Chair Erickson, will turn it over to you for the next portion of this and keep things moving for ourselves.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have with me Judy Randall, the Deputy Legislative Auditor, to give some highlights of both the program and the financial audits of Purpich, because I think there are only a couple of members at the tables here who have heard the audit report. And so for us to have this level of understanding, I think it's important.
Welcome to the committee, and a general high overview, because we do have folks who need to be at different places and things, so, and there may be some questions that come your way. So give you a chance to do some overview, identify yourself for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor for OLA's Program Evaluation Division. And, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to make it quick. Earlier this year, we released both a financial audit and a program evaluation related to the Purpich Center for Arts Education. As you know, Purpich Center is a state agency, but we found a significant number of problems through both our financial audit and our program evaluation. Related to our financial audit, we found significant repeat findings, which is not something we usually see with state agencies. And I'm just going to read real quickly. Our overall conclusion is that they didn't resolve some prior audit findings, and they did not adequately assess its financial risks or monitor the effectiveness of its internal controls. And I know that sounds like audit gobbledygook and kind of benign, but actually it's a really strong finding from our office to find that they did not adequately manage their financial controls. So we had serious concerns related to our financial audit. Our program evaluation looked more generally at the governance and operations of the Purpich Center for Arts Education. As you probably know from testimony this morning, the Purpich Center has three different kind of realms of responsibility. It has responsibility for statewide arts education outreach. It operates an arts high school that serves grades 11 and 12 in Golden Valley. It also provides boarding there for students from outstate. And then it also operates Crosswinds Middle School, which is in Woodbury, and serves students in grades 6 through 10. We found significant problems with the Purpich Center related to board oversight, significant problems related to agency leadership and management, poor test scores, and declining enrollment. So these two reports taken together, the financial audit and the program evaluation, really culminated in some significant concerns. And in our report, we outlined four options for the legislature to consider regarding the governance and operations of the Purpich Center. And one of those options was the closing of the Purpich Center, which is what's contained in this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Members, questions of the auditor's overview? Representative Stanstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What were the other options?
Mr. Chair and Representative, thank you for the question. We go through the four options and we kind of say pros and cons for each of them. Option one is to maintain the current scope and responsibilities. And, you know, we think that significant changes would have to happen. In the report, we have, I think, 14 recommendations to the Purpich Center. So if they were going to kind of stay on the same course, we thought a lot of changes would have to happen. Option two was to no longer operate Crosswinds School, the middle school in Woodbury. Option three was to do only the statewide arts education outreach, but not operate either of the schools. And then option four was to close altogether.
And in that option, you know, I think there's ways to unwind PERPETCH, you know, moving the statewide arts education outreach responsibilities perhaps to the Department of Education, finding another home, maybe for Crosswinds, and maybe for Arts High School.
Representative Sanchez, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in my experience, and I testified earlier today, but when a problem is identified in the world of education or maybe even business, oftentimes, you know, you try to remediate the problem. You identify the problem. You lay out your expectations of what needs to change. It's time-bound, and the consequences are put forth. And those are all the things that kind of happen in a simultaneous fashion. Has that happened? Has that option been given to PERPETCH?
Auditor.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think that would be the report is kind of laying out suggestions for improvement and identification of the problems. And then it's really up to the legislature now on what steps to take forward of if you want to kind of set forth these expectations and then see the process unfold or if you want to move forward with this bill.
Representative Stanis, follow-up.
Thank you. It just seems like this bill is shutting it down before the follow-through has happened. And I think, as I stated earlier, this impacts students and students' lives. And if the process has been followed and we've really given our best shot at it, fine. But I don't think that's happened, and I think from the most heartfelt way I can say this, I think this is the wrong move at this time. I think there are better ways of doing this, and I think we should take a look at that before we move on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions for Ms. Randall? Representative Jessup.
Chair Driscoll, this is really a message for Representative Sanstead and more in confirmation of what you're hearing from the OLA. When Judy first gave her reports and she went through all of the significant findings and such, my assessment at that point was, and this is from a small business owner with four stores, that given all of the issues that were taking place at this particular school, if this was a business, it would have been shut down 3 to 4 years prior. There are significant concerns going on. One of the key elements that I would give to you are two. Is when the PERPETCH Center was established, it was 30-some years ago. The education landscape today versus 30 years ago is significantly different. You have many, many art education options available to students today that did not exist then. And what has occurred is the enrollment has gone down significantly. The from a student standpoint, there at least has not been the interest in terms of the number of students that are there. And so that is one key element that I would just suggest. The other that the auditor may not have given to you is that the performance of the students on all of the testing, and you know testing much, much better than I do, but that the scores themselves were below where we would have anticipated them to be just for a typical school. So there was issues going on in a number of different directions as her report laid out for us at that initial presentation.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, well, I mean, I would dispute the contention. I think I saw this in your expression that there are, I mean, certainly in the metro area, there are some arts schools out there. I don't know the extent to which there are art schools in greater Minnesota, and this is a statewide asset. And it's, I mean, I don't know that I would use the business analogy. It's a school. It's not a business. I got on the list, though. I did have a question for the deputy auditor. In the OLA report, when you describe option four, you describe it as the most drastic of the options for the legislature to consider. And you note a few things that you felt needed to happen first before closure could be considered. I'm just wondering if you could outline those a bit for the benefit of the members who haven't read the full report.
Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Freiberg. Sure, I'm happy to do so. And I will note that in our report we lay out these four options, and we don't recommend one over the other, and we think it's important to have this exact conversation here. So a couple of things that we think would need to happen is one, determine whether the Arts High School and Crosswind School would continue in some other form
whether it's a charter school, part of the school district, or something else. And I know there have already been conversations related to that for Crosswinds. I'm not sure about for the Arts High School. There's also some physical assets that would have to be thought about. The Purbridge Center, the Arts High School, and Crosswinds School are now are all currently state-owned assets. And so what the state decides to do with those would have to be figured out. And then also the transition of the statewide arts education outreach functions, how that would transition to the Department of Education. I think all four options have some things that seem like a quick fix and then have some messy parts to them. So, and I think this one is no exception. I think the unwinding of the center, you know, would take some effort.
Representative Freiberg, follow-up. Mm-hmm. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Erickson. And I had a phone call this afternoon from a person that said they were an alumni of the school. And I think closing it is a rather drastic step, and I think it closes out a possibility that can help some students. The way this individual talked to me, that this was their savior. This was what got them through high school, to being able to go there and go to this school. They said they were alone. They at their regular high school they're from. They, you know, were isolated, and they just didn't feel part of it. By going, being able to go to this Purpose Center and going to the high school there, they were able to. So they it got them through high school, got them through college, got them on the right path. And it's I think it bothers me a little bit, and that we're going to this radical step of shutting this down when there's not going to be another option for some of these kids. I mean, and every person, kid, whatever, learns in a different way, has different things they need to get them through. And if we're going to shut this down, there's a whole lot of people that are going to be left adrift. And my point is, we need all these people in our future. We need all these kids to get through high school, get through some higher education so they can get decent jobs, because we're going to need them in our workforce. And shutting this down, to me, is closing off to a whole group of people something that might be the thing that keeps them in school and keeps them moving ahead. So I can't support this bill the way it is now. I just think we're taking a drastic step, and I think there's been some changes made there. I've heard that they're trying to peel off the Crosswinds to the St. Paul School District so that they can, you know, do that piece of it and concentrate on the mission and what the Perkins Center originally was. So I think this is a drastic step for us to take at this time.
Ms. Randall, I don't have any other member questions at this time, so I thank you for your time. And the next item is the DE1 amendment. Is there anyone going to be offering the DE1 amendment this evening? Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to offer the DE1 amendment.
Representative Freiberg offers the DE1 amendment to House File 1826. Representative Freiberg for the DE amendment.
Well, sure. We've heard, I guess just to back up a bit, I mean, you know, I don't know that everybody's familiar with this. I happen to live in the city that the Purpose Center is located in. It's not actually in my district. It's across the street from it. But, my nephew went to the high school. Had a great experience. I've received, just over the course of the time I've been here, I've received hundreds of emails about the people who received a world-class education there that would not be available anywhere else, as Representative Nelson mentioned. I think everybody agrees there have been some leadership issues there. It's certainly not the first state agency or board that has had leadership issues, but we've heard from the new chair already today. We've heard from the new principal, and I've met with them independently of this hearing, and you know, find them to be very impressive people who I think deserve a chance to turn this around, because it is such an important asset to our state and it fills such an important function. I know Representative Sandstead spoke very well about the training she received there. I mean, obviously the high school kind of gets a lot of attention and can really kind of tug at your heartstrings a bit too, but the arts outreach portion of what the center does is equally important, and certainly it hasn't been doing enough of it lately, but I'm optimistic with the new leadership there that it can turn itself around. When the bill was presented, it was presented sort of as the start of a conversation, and I think that's kind of a euphemism here. I mean, what we're talking about, even the legislative auditor's report describes this as a drastic option. As legislators, we hold tremendous power. I kind of question whether or not a super political body such as the legislature should be in the business of operating a K-12 school, just because it's so important. I mean, it's the life for the students who go there. I mean, so here we are talking about this, throwing tremendous uncertainty into a K-12 school, which is, for many of these people, the most important place in their life. I mean, it's a boarding school. It's their home. And so here we are with this really drastic bill out there, and just throwing the whole thing, throwing these kids' lives into such a period of uncertainty. That's what this bill does. I think we need to be upfront about that. So it's been there for 30 years. The OLA report says that there are steps that should be taken before this drastic approach is taken. It says we should determine whether the Arts High School and Crosswinds will continue in some other form, determine what to do with the buildings that the Purpose Center, Arts High School, and Crosswinds School now occupy. And I don't think we're there. I've heard from the city I live in that there's a concern that, what happens if these just sit vacant for a long time? And determine how to transition the outreach functions. I don't feel like this bill does that. I don't feel like we've taken these steps yet. I don't feel like this bill, even assuming that option 4 is the right one, I don't feel like the steps that the OLA report describes have been taken yet. So I don't think we're ready. I don't think we're ready to go this far. So I had prepared the DE1 amendment. It has two elements to it. The first part does set into motion one of the options recommended by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. I think just because of all the issues going on at Purpich, managing a second school all the way on the other side of town is probably not what it should be focusing on right now. So this does transition the Crosswinds School and sets a date by which it has to be transferred. I know that the St. Paul School District has expressed interest in it yet, but I don't think that's been finalized yet. So this doesn't specify any specific conveyance entity that would receive it. I know Representative Fenton asked before about the South Washington District. If it turns out that they do end up, that district does end up being interested in acquiring the Crosswinds building, then I think that would be allowable under this amendment. And the second part just asks for a report back to the legislature about several of the issues identified by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. So it says that the Purpose Center has to report by the legislature by 2019 on its progress under this section and identify actions taken to address, if you look on the back of it, appropriate discretion and agency oversight, increase transparency and solicit public input, increase student enrollment at the Arts High School, performing outreach activities, providing support to arts educators and students throughout Minnesota, improve student performance on state assessments. I'm optimistic with the new leadership that we have there that we can really turn this around, because it's such an important institution for our state. I think Governor Purpich, when he set it up, really had a vision for the arts flourishing in Minnesota. I think it's consistent with what we've done by passing the legacy amendment, and I hope that members would consider supporting it. And I'd like a roll call on the amendment.
Good. I was just going to ask one for that as well, so I'm glad we both agree on that, Representative Freiberg. To the bill author, Chair Erickson.
Mr. Chair, I would recommend a no vote. These decisions have to be made in the Committee on Education Finance. We're the committee that has jurisdiction over educational facilities. This is an educational facility. We are here because we're following the process. Representative Loon has 1825, which will be debated in the Finance Committee. So with that said, Mr. Chair, I recommend a no vote.
Any other discussion on the DE1 amendment? Representative Freiberg.
Just to the whole issue of jurisdiction, I mean, we did hear from Ms. Dyson earlier that essentially because this bill would eliminate a state agency, that the entire bill is within the purview of the Government Operations Committee. So I think it's very appropriate for us to discuss this.
Any other discussion on the DE1 amendment? A roll call being requested. Seeing no other member questions, the clerk will take the roll.
O'Driscoll?
No.
Pugh?
No.
Bliss?
No.
Fenton?
No.
Freiberg?
Yes.
Halverson?
Yes.
Jessup? No. Lee?
Yes.
Mason? Nash?
Nope.
Nelson?
Yes.
Peterson?
No.
Quam?
No.
Sandsted?
Yes.
Brzezinski?
No.
Tice? West?
No.
Youakim?
Yes.
There being 6 ayes and 10 nays, the DE1 amendment does not prevail and is not adopted. Members, are there any other questions at this time of the bill author? Seeing none and hearing none, I renew my motion that House File 1826 be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. With that, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Representative Chair Erickson, you are on your way. The next bill will bring up House File House File 1001. And Representative Vogel, I will move House File 1001 to be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs and Energy. And we are bringing this back. This is a bill we had heard earlier this session. We laid it over, and at this time we'd like to move this. And so with that, Representative Vogel, just ask you to kind of refresh the committee members as to the genesis behind the bill, and we'll take questions if we have them from there. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. This is the bill that deals with having legislative approval if there's going to be $1,000 or more increase in the price of a housing unit for the regulations. It basically has the regulator having to come up with a cost estimate. If not, administrative law judge would, and then there's a procedure within the bill that if there's going to happen, that it would then have legislative approval. And the rationale behind this is because of the increase in housing costs that we're seeing and the unaffordability that's happening because we're cutting people out of the marketplace. So, brief synopsis of the bill. The reason I requested that we re-refer is I got a request for a fiscal note, and I assume that we're going to have a financial issue that we need to get to, which would be in the Jobs and Energy Committee.
Thank you, Representative Vogel. Members, questions on the House File 1001. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Vogel. Why the $1,000? I mean, I worked a carpenter most of my life, and doesn't take much to increase the cost of a house $1,000. I can understand possibly doing something similar to this as far as to help builders and help keep costs down, but $1,000 seems an awful low bar where we'd end up stopping any rule that might be for health or safety or anything that would affect housing. $1,000 isn't very much to cover. That'd be like saying, you know, $1 or $1.50. That's, you know, it's a low bar to cross.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, it's always hard to establish an amount when you're going to do something like this. One of the issues that we're facing is the cumulative effect of if it was just $1,000 maybe every 4 years that a new regulation was coming aboard. But what's happening is there's multiple regulations that are adding multiple thousands, and you know, I'd have to look back in my research, but there's been studies done about how many people are cut out of the marketplace for each $1,000 a house goes up.
And this isn't only addressing just the cost of the construction of the house, but also the construction of the lot. So there are multiple regulations that are impacting this, and it's just becoming unbearable for people, and unfortunately, especially keeping lower income and first-time buyers out of the marketplace, and we're just not developing like we should.
Representative Nelson, follow-up.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand the housing market. In fact, sometimes there's the cost of regulations may be a pittance to what's going on. A lot of it's supply and demand. I know right now the supply of houses is very low. We put my mother's house on the market last Friday. They had 12 showings between Friday and Saturday, and she got almost $14,000 above what she listed it at, and sold the house on Monday, and it's going to be closed in a month. So, I mean, some of this has nothing to do with regulations or anything else. It has to do with the supply and demand and how they're built. And I, as I said, coming out of the construction field, I know that I understand something to make differences in the house, what a house costs. Again, my parents, when they bought their house, it was in a suburb, it was a new addition out in Brooklyn Center. At the time they bought the house, it was just the house, a well and a septic system, no garage, no driveway. Streets weren't even in. They were still gravel roads, no yard. They had a fight many years to do that, no trees. I mean, some of the stuff that we are talking about here that could add significant cost to the house are stuff that are being required by housing developments, and but they're much more than $1,000. So Mr. Chair, this bill, like I said, it's why I do agree that some of this stuff may be good to look at, but we're talking health and safety issues. A lot of times the rules that we're talking about are health and safety issues, are ordinances that the cities have put in, but it's also building codes that we're going to say we're not going to have to build it to this building code because it's going to cost more than $1,000 because we changed the building code with the new material. So, Mr. Chair, I have problems with this bill.
Representative Nelson, just a comment on your comments. I'm sure that the people who own property are glad that you don't write the ads for them. Yeah. Gravel road, out of town, not improved. But it's a real looker.
Mr. Chair, back, you know, this is part one of the problems we're having with when we talk about building affordable housing. Contractor, just to get to the lot, the house you're building on it, you know, some of the requirements that have to be in. Now they build developments, they have to have sewer and water in, they have to have roads in, they have to, when they build the house, they got to put a full yard in. My brother-in-law, when he bought his house a few years back, they had to have a tree, and it had to be over 2 inches in diameter. Things like that.
And if it died, you had to replace it.
And a lot of them are requiring 2 and 3 car garages. Well, now you're getting above where you're not going to build affordable housing because of those requirements. And I understand that, you know, those are much more than $1,000 each, those things. But like I said, back in the 50s, when they built these houses for the returning vets and these were starter homes, they were basically the house. And everything else you added on afterwards, and now those communities look a lot different than they did back in the 50s, but back then when they built them, it wasn't more than just the house that they were promised. The other stuff they had to do themselves.
Agreed. So, and my experience in the real estate industry, which is slightly different than yours, I was on the ad writing part of that, and that's why I brought it up.
No, I understand.
Representative Vogel, just a question for you to Representative Nelson's point. Yours doesn't talk about a market value fluctuation. It talks about an impact of regulation or rule proposed. Am I correct on that?
Correct.
Which could have an impact on the value. I just want to make sure that with the conversation we're having, that it didn't mean that in the very fortunate situation you had the market with your mother's home, which is a great thing, that would be completely independent of what we're talking about with Representative Vogel's bill here this evening, that those are market forces versus a regulation that we were looking at. Other member questions on House File 1001. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there going to be other testifiers? Or
We did take testimony on this. This is a bill that we had laid over.
Okay.
And so we're simply bringing it back for consideration for moving it on to the Jobs Committee this evening.
Okay. Thank you for the reminder. Late. the author or perhaps to testifier, I have questions about how much of an impact this has on the current or potential affordable housing stock. How much new construction is considered to be aimed at that first-time home buyer and that affordable housing stock? It certainly isn't a lot of new construction in my neck of the woods, but I don't know how that compares statewide, because I think that making sure the first-time home buyers have affordable housing stock makes a lot of sense. But I'm curious about what kind of impact we are driving at in the new construction market.
Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yeah, I, one of the reasons that this grabbed my attention is because the impact is more significant on the smaller priced houses. So if you have a regulation that costs, say, $2,000 on a $100,000 house, it's 2% of the cost, whereas if you have a $500,000 it might be the same fixed cost, but proportionally doesn't it affects affordable housing more. And one of the difficulties that we are having is that you don't see houses being built anymore, unfortunately, for $150,000. And you know, from the statistics I'm looking at here, it looks like almost 50% of the people are priced out of the market at $175,000. I really, you know, think that we have to, you know, start watching what's happening here so that we don't price, especially younger people, and those first-time buyers out of the market. And disproportionately, I think the regulations relative to what they have to spend affects them more.
Representative Halverson, follow-up?
Yes, thanks, Mr. Chair. Well, that's really interesting in terms of where the threshold is for first-time home buyers and where we market to for first-time home buyers. Do you have a sense that it is the state regulation driving these costs, or do you, because it seems to me that what we see locally is a much bigger driver in terms of lot size, setbacks, driveways, size of the home. To me, that seems like it's a much bigger driver, and so I'm wondering how much of an impact this might have.
Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair and Representative, there's no doubt that the local restrictions and regulations and standards that they're setting is impacting this. This is something that we have control over, and my feeling is that maybe if we take the lead and start treating regulation seriously, that maybe other local units of government may do the same. And again, it's a cumulative thing. So whatever we can do to help, my feeling is that that we should do it.
Representative Halverson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I still feel like I'm missing the information about where the market is at currently. It sounds like the market has already left the first-time home buyers behind, and that's not where new construction is at, that's not where our market is at. And so I'm wondering if it puzzles me that it doesn't sound like this is a solution. It sounds like the first-time home buyer is already left behind if the threshold, you know, for a first-time home buyer is under the $200,000 mark or even in the mid-$200,000. That's not what new construction seems to be going for, at least what I'm seeing.
Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair and Representative, you're correct that the pricing has got up. One of the important things of this bill is it also covers remodeling. So there are some homes that are older and may allow a person to get in. But again, when we start adding too many regulations, it also affects those homes. So I agree that it's, and that's, like I said, one of the reasons I was so interested in this bill is to try to get a handle on this. But it's also important to remember that it does affect, it does address remodeling as well. So maybe it gives a chance to somebody that's trying to get into a house that's been 40, 50, 60 years old, that those regulations become a little bit more oppressive than what they can afford as well.
Representative Halverson.
Well, I can relate because I have a totally 80s house, so I'd love to remodel my kitchen, but it's not going to happen anytime soon.
Well, if Representative Vogel has his way, if the cost goes up by $1,000, maybe it might be covered by regulation. So, other member questions at this time? Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And
I guess if this bill passes and becomes law, I look forward to all this plethora of new homes that are going to be being built in the affordable house range. But I'm afraid that if we're not keeping the building codes, and this is what we're talking about, the state level, the building codes, they're going to be being new home buyers, first-time home buyers, moving into substandard houses that don't meet life and safety requirements. And I think I look forward to all these new houses being built and all these first-time home buyers being able to buy these substandard houses.
Representative Halverson, I spoke in error. We actually did have one person who did sign up in advance to testify. And because we do want to have a good hearing on this, I'm going to invite Mr. Ben Rabe to come down to speak. And then if there's anyone else here this evening that would like to speak on the matter before the committee, again, we do like some transparency here in this committee. So with that, Mr. Rabe, I'm going to invite you to come in, state your name, who you represent, and proceed with your testimony, sir.
Hello. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to come and testify today. My name is Ben Rabe. I'm a senior policy associate at Fresh Energy, an independent nonprofit that provides policy research and analysis on energy issues across the state. I previously ran an energy efficiency program for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and currently coordinate the Minnesota Energy Codes Compliance Collaborative of builders, building officials, utilities, energy experts that works to improve the way the code is implemented. Our concerns about this bill center around the lifetime cost of owning a house and the regulatory uncertainty this bill would create in the marketplace. First, homes that are well built have a much lower cost of ownership. The sticker price of a house does very little to describe the actual cost of home ownership. Even if certain changes to the code would save a marginal amount of money, those would not be real savings. Artificially lowering the sticker price of a home by setting lower standards for construction will simply lead to much higher monthly energy costs and much greater risk of expensive repairs down the road. That's not what Minnesota families want. A consumer union and building codes assistance project survey comprising of over 5,000 respondents showed that 79% of home buyers would rather pay slightly more for a new home and have affordable, predictable operating costs and energy bills. Second, Minnesota is known for having well-built homes because of our tradition of setting common sense standards. There's no need to throw a wrench in a process by creating a redundant layer of regulation at the Capitol. In 2015, lawmakers voted to move Minnesota into a six-year code cycle. Within that time frame, there's a three-year stakeholder process where everyone across the industry has a chance to weigh in their concerns and suggestions. Slowing down that six-year process would even further send an uncertain signal to the market that Minnesota is not open for business. For decades, we've sent common-sense standards for high-quality home builders to meet, and Minnesotans should be proud of its reputation for well-built homes. They cut energy waste while lowering monthly bills for families in our communities. Rather than build substandard homes that require expensive repairs later on, let's build our homes the right way. Thanks.
Mr. Rabe, thank you. Members, questions for Mr. Rabe on his testimony today? Thank you, sir. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on the matter before the committee this evening? House file 1001. Seeing none, hearing none, we've had some member discussion. I don't see any other member questions. With that, I am going to renew my motion that House File 1001 be re-referred to the Committee on Jobs and Energy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, same
side. No.
The motion prevails. Representative Vogel, you are on your way, sir.
Thank you.
And our final bill this evening is House File 1663. And as Representative Erickson repositions herself for the third time today, from this morning and then coming back, and then her gracious willingness to allow Representative Vogel to get in, you're going to be our final bill this evening. I will move House File 1663 to be re-referred to the Committee on Higher Education. And Representative Erickson, with that, I will turn it over to you for the presentation of the bill. Chair Erickson.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure it goes to higher ed. Is that how you were directed?
I have higher ed on here, and
you can remake the motion at the end of the hearing.
believe that it returns or moves to the Committee on Education Finance.
Chair Erickson, that is what I thought, but we've got folks here who have the same. Here's what we're going to do. Given the lateness of the hour, we still have the ability to hold it in the committee, and we can move to reconsider if we are, in fact, sending it to the wrong committee. On second thought, let's send it to EdFi, and then if we have to, we will recall it from there instead of going that way. That's probably the easiest way to handle that this evening.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
So, Representative Erickson, let me start again, bringing the bill back. I move that House File 1663 be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. With that, it is now before the committee officially. Chair Erickson, please proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1663 is the Teacher Shortage Act. It is a follow-up from last year, and in this proposal, we create in Section 13 a Teacher Shortage Task Force. It is created managed by the Department of Education, which is why I questioned the motion, because this doesn't have anything to do with higher ed, but it does have a lot to do with the Department of Education convening this advisory task force of 12 members. And you can see the membership listed in your bill, representing most of the education organizations that we have in the state, plus, of course, a representative from our colleges and universities' board-approved teacher preparation programs. The intent is to review the data on recruitment and retention, to refer to the supply and demand report that is done annually, to reach some conclusions, if possible, about why it is we continue to suffer a teacher shortage in Minnesota. So, Mr. Chair, that really is all I need to tell you. I think the commissioner has to appoint by September 1, and the meetings have, the commissioner has to appoint, and the first meeting she has to convene by September 1 of 17. And this task force will stay in motion until 2020, January of 2020. And, of course, the reports will come to the respective education committees. So that, Mr. Chair, in a nutshell, is what this is about, and I'm here because it's a task force, and you review task forces. Correct, Mr. Gearing?
Two things. The primary section that's and why this bill is in our committee is Section 13, the creation of the task force. So members, that is on, believe it or not, 13.13 for Section 13. So I don't know how that works out, but it does. Right? And then that will conclude on the next page. I've been advised that the reason that we have been asked to refer this to higher education is that Section 7, which I am turning to right now in the bill, has some references to higher education. Section 7, if you take a look, it says Alternative Teacher Preparation Grant, and then it talks about the Commissioner of Higher Education in there. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where we ended up with that. So Representative Erickson, we'll defer to you as to whether you want to continue to send this to Education Finance, or if you think we should swing it through higher ed and let them re-refer it to you, if that is the wishes of the various committees that this would need to stop at.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, the grant program is funded through the K-12 budget. So,
We certainly want to try to help you and help the process if we can. Mm-hmm. So we can leave it going to Education Finance, and then if there's an issue, we can re-refer it from there if it makes it out of committee. Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, and I don't know if this is where it's added in the Senate and where it is added deadlines. If higher ed is the policy committee, they need to hear it, sending it to Education Finance. From there, would if it could get heard Friday, moved on the floor tomorrow if we pass it out of here, that it would keep it safe for deadlines. If it goes to finance and then has to be moved back down there, it might not get a hearing in time to make deadlines, assuming that it's not meeting deadlines in the Senate. I guess that might be where to help Representative Eric, and they may be where we want to send it so they could get it heard and get sent to a finance committee and meet deadlines on Friday.
Representative Nelson, thank you for sharing those thoughts. What I think I'm going to do and get you and I both off the hook on this, I'm just going to ask Mr. Gehring if he thinks that it could either. This is what we do. No, I didn't kick it down the road. I just kicked it next door. And ask him what he thinks might happen or what are some of our options. Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, so I guess I don't have a suggestion on where the bill should go, but I just observed that the Higher Ed Committee is also a finance committee, so it's not a policy-only committee that would need to meet deadlines tomorrow. So either place that it would go would meet deadlines.
So I think we get to decide which committee hears it next. So, Representative Erickson, are you wanting to first go to Higher Ed or to Ed Phi?
Mr. Chair, to the Committee on Education and Finance.
So we will leave the motion the way it is right now because it does ask for it to go to the Committee on Education and Finance. So with that, members, are there questions? Again, just to review, 13.13, Section 13, is the part that's within the purview of our committee.
Establishing and Mr. Chair, the task we asked the revisor to do that for us.
They had to get an awful lot of extra words and wordsmithing to get it to line up just as such. Seeing no member questions, Representative Erickson. Oh, we do have a question. It looks like Representative Halverson.
We can't not have any questions for the office.
Sure, we can.
We're famous
we'll go ahead.
In this committee for good questions. Representative Erickson, Chair Erickson. Question I have with regard to the what the duties are of the task force. Is there current information out there, current studies that have been done by any of these bodies that are being assigned to the task force? It feels to me like I've seen a fair amount of research on reasons for teacher shortages in Minnesota, both in the metro area based on certain study areas that we have shortages, and then also in greater Minnesota in terms of where people are putting down their roots and choosing to teach. So where is the science today on this? Where are the studies today on this?
Representative Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members, and Representative Halverson. The supply and demand report that is done through the Commissioner's Office here in Minnesota supplies us with data. And then there are national studies that have been done by many reputable organizations, Education Trust being among them, that are studying across the nation the shortage that we're experiencing in the classroom, because this is a national problem. It's not just a state problem. So I think from all of the studies that are being done and evolving, that this group will have quite a lot of data to draw some conclusions from.
Representative Halverson, follow-up.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I see that there are, are significant costs associated with creating this task force and creating this report, and I just wonder how much duplication is going to happen in terms of the information that already exists through the agencies that are named in this task force, and to your point, national studies as well. So I just would be concerned in terms of creating duplication.
Representative Halverson, that's why I'm sending two different finance committees because there are some costs associated with that. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Erickson, I think this is a good thing to set up this task force to look at this, because I know talking to my school district administrators that the shortness of supply of teachers is there, and also teachers of color. And I see on the list of the people on the task force, there's nothing here that excludes them, but there's nothing here that specifically asks for anybody of color to be on this. I know in our school district there, my superintendent is working hard to try and recruit people into that, and there's not a large supply of them out there, is what I was told last year when I asked about that. So the people on the task force looks to be a good, rounded group of educators, but if we're trying to recruit more teachers of color into the classrooms, I'm just a thought to maybe look at adding somebody or having that on there. I see later on here there's talks about teachers of color in another section, but and the task force, there's nothing specifically laying those out.
Chair Erickson.
Mr. Chair and members and Representative Nelson, we've set this up so that each of these organizations has a designated person. They're going to choose someone, and we're thinking that they're going to choose, not thinking, we're hoping, I'm hoping, that that choice will certainly be a good cross-section of what we have coming from, you know, School Boards Association, AMSD, you know, which is the Metropolitan Association of School Districts, has just a great diversity, and Minnesota Rural Education Association, also because we have communities where we have many Somalis today, many Hispanics, and so I trust that they're going to choose as their designee. They're not themselves going to be there. They're going to have a designee, and I imagine they'll sit on the sidelines like we always do with these task forces to determine.
Representative Nelson, follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope that that's what happens, but I'm just excited. I notice that there's nothing here pointing that out, and I know that's one area that we have a large shortage of applicants going into it, and it's difficult. I mean, Kate McGuire from Osceola School District is the one. Last year I sat with her, and she gave a nice speech at the AMSD talking about that, and I asked her, well, are there teachers out there to hire? And there isn't a supply of them, and they get sucked up, not only from other districts in Minnesota, but around the country. And so if there's not a supply, it's hard to hire them if they're not in the pipeline to come out the other end to be hired. So I hope that this committee or this task force is diversified enough so that we get those different inputs from different.
Representative Sandstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know you have the different organizations that can appoint a person or recommend a person, but is there a teacher? Is it ever spelled out that a teacher would be part of this?
Mr. Chair and Representative Sandstead, I think that person would come from Education Minnesota. They're listed on here. So they certainly will appoint a teacher, I hope.
Well, maybe, but it doesn't spell it out. Thank you.
Seeing no other member questions, I will renew my motion that House File 1663 be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion carries. Representative Erickson, you are on your way. Members, before we finish this evening, just a couple of housekeeping details. We normally meet at 10:15. Tomorrow we have session at 10 o'clock. Rules usually meets at 10 o'clock in this room. So what's going to happen when we're done with session, we will come over, we will wait for the room to turn over with rules, and we will start immediately after rules is done. So that's going to be driven by how long the floor is on, things are on the House floor. Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Gelbin just whispered in my ear that rules will be meeting in the Capitol, but
That is correct. I had forgotten about that, the lateness of the hour. They will come find us, those of us who are on this committee and are on rules. But, yes, it does meet over in the Capitol, and we will convene as soon as we can after the completion of rules. So ask people to stand by for that. And plan again tomorrow evening, depending upon discussions, because we are meeting on Friday, in order to be able to finish our work for the first round of deadlines. And I'll have more information on that tomorrow. With that, we are adjourned.